You're listening to the Cannabis Podcast with Martin and Jonesy.
So it's been a while, but we're finally back with the Cannabis Podcast. I'm Martin Lane, the co-founder of Cannabis, and joining me is our chief correspondent, Steve Jones.
Hi there. Hello, good to be back.
It is. It has been quite some time. And our guest today is cannabis industry consultant and former Freshleaf Analytics MD, Cassandra Hunt.
Hi, Martin. Hi, Steve. Thank you for inviting me to join you today.
It's our pleasure. So, Cass, you left Freshleaf, I think it was the back end of last year, wasn't it?
That's right.
So what have you been up to?
So I'm still working in the industry in an advisory capacity, but I'm now focusing my energy on working with two organisations. And so the first organisation I'm working with is a company called MCA, Medical Cannabis Australia. They are essentially a startup, a team of very entrepreneurial, bright, motivated people. We've got some quite exciting and sort of bold vision for what we want to do in the industry. And we'll be launching some products at the start of next year as our sort of first foray, and watch this space on that organization after then. The second company I'm working with is the Nickham Health Research Institute. So I have an adjunct fellow role with them. And that role, is one of the objectives is to help them build their medicinal cannabis program. And they are doing a lot of really cool stuff actually in this space. So they've got some R&D programs underway. They're doing clinical research in areas like endometriosis, insomnia, mild cognitive impairment is another one. They also are about to finish construction on a GMP facility that's in-house. And so they'll have the ability to extract, formulate, and manufacture cannabis medicines as well as other natural medicines very, very soon. And they'll be able to do that for not only R&D programs, but also for small-scale commercial purposes. And then the last thing I'll mention that they're doing is they're a key partner in the Hemp CRC bid. And the Hemp CRC bid is effectively a collaboration between industry and a number of different research organisations that, if successful, will bring a lot of R&D funding to hemp. And we use that term broadly. Medical cannabis is included in that umbrella. And it's a 10-year program. So that would be a significant step change in terms of the sort of funding that would be available to us, both in the medical side, but also things like industrial hemp.
Okay, so did I hear right? So Nickham will have a small commercial operation, did you say?
So they have the ability to do a small commercial operation there if they so desire. Obviously, clinical research is their first priority. And so that's where, you know, how the manufacturing facility will be used. But potentially, it could be small scale commercial production also.
Interesting. Okay. Well, we'll leave that there for now, I think. So just sort of first topic that I kind of intrigued me last week was we ran an opinion piece from Chronos Australia CEO Rodney Cox, who was predicting a bright future for the industry. But he did kind of warn that some firms, I think the quote was, some firms will succeed, some will not, and others will merge. And obviously, we've already seen Chronos and CDA merge last year. We've potentially got Criso Pharma acquiring Health House. And we've reported recently on some other companies sort of selling, going into administration. So it feels like some are starting to struggle a bit. Cass, I remember in your Freshleaf days, you spent many a day or a webinar predicting that there'd be consolidation. So why do you think it's happening now? And do you think we're at some sort of tipping point from an industry point of view?
So, yes, we are absolutely at a tipping point. And look, we spotted this a while ago with Freshleaf because the signals of potential trouble have been there for a while. And it's a whole bunch of different factors that are coming together at this time. So things like the fact that we're in a really hyper-competitive market, the products are effectively commodity products because we haven't yet gotten to a point where we're commercializing a lot of the R&D that's been happening. We're obviously heavily regulated, which makes it, you know, difficult more difficult to operate in. We've seen price absolutely, you know, tank since legalization in 2016, and a lot of companies have made huge capital investments so that they can cultivate and manufacture onshore. So it's really tough to build a viable business under those conditions. And you add to that today's economic climate, you know, a lot of the funding that might have been available in the past is drying up and it's not there anymore. And so, you know, I think what we're seeing is really the start of the of change that's going to continue for a while yet.
And I mean, is that a good thing?
I think it is a good thing, actually, because, you know, there was some research that you guys reported on recently. I think it was Nostra Data that put the data into the market. And look, there are some questions about whether or not there's bias in that data. But if you look at it, it sort of says that the top 10 players have 93% of the market. Now, there are at least 50 or 60 different product companies who have medicines in the market, which means that those, you know, there's 50 companies who have 7% market share. It's a very, very small piece of the pie that those companies are fighting over. And so I do think it's a good thing for the industry that we start to see, you know, some of the companies come sort of consolidate and come together. And we want to see companies succeed in this space. And I think that's what it's going to take to make that happen.
With the tanking prices, I mean, maybe not great for the companies, but beneficial for the patients, presumably. I mean,
yes, and in a weird way, it kind of is beneficial for the companies because so absolutely. You know, it's excellent for patients that prices are coming down and they're still too high. We do need to see the medicine come down in price. It's still too expensive. We know that patients aren't taking their, you know, the dose that the doctor has prescribed to them, or they might not be continuing with the medication when they need it. The weird piece in terms of how it could be good for industry is that we've finally reached a point where the price is on par with the green market. And we know that there are hundreds of thousands of patients who are medicating through the illicit channels. So actually what's good for industry is as the prices come down, we will see that market growth come from, you know, that illicit market channel. And that's going to help grow the legal industry.
Janzi, you kind of chat to the sort of senior people at the big cannabis companies all the time. What's the sort of take that you're getting from them on this?
I think it's a very similar one to what Cass was talking about. To be honest, there's a growing realization that there'll be mergers, there'll be acquisitions, and there'll be failures. You know, we've seen a couple the last sort of 2 or 3 months. You know, the Tikkun being one of them. You know, they won't be the last to fall over. I think that's pretty clear. What's also clear, there's been plenty of conversations behind the scenes that have been taking place. And they've been going on for quite a while. And you look at the financial results over the last couple of weeks from the listed companies, you know, some are sailing pretty close to the wind in terms of their financials. So I think those conversations are going to continue. I think there's going to be a sense of urgency with some companies that they need to partner, you know, to avoid ultimately going under. You know, as Kat said, not everybody's going to survive this. And I think there's a realization from the industry executives that's the case.
And I'm interested in kind of from a sort of strategic point of view. Obviously, you've got a lot going on in the market. You've got, you know, eventually there will be an over-the-counter CBD medicine at some point in Australia. You know, you've got this move, as you said, Cass, to you know, the increasing popularity of flower. Interesting, particularly among sort of younger men. You know, there's a few things going on. I mean, in terms of a kind of, you know, who's got the strategy right, I guess is the question. You know, we've seen big cultivation facilities get built and, you know, waiting for a return on that investment. We've seen other people try and be sort of lean and mean. You've got Kronos, you know, just paid a dividend, you know, first medicinal cannabis company to pay a dividend, and obviously on the back of the merger with CDA Health and the CanView platform, which is all about ease of access for patients. So who's, you know, not asking any you to name names, but from a strategic point of view, who do you think the kind of what's going to be the right strategy, do you think?
Yeah, so strategy is contextual to the time in which you take that strategy to market, right? And so I think that if we talk about now, you know, the proof is in the pudding when you look at the numbers. As you said, Kronos is the first publicly listed company to pay a dividend in Australia in the cannabis industry. They, when they merged with CDA, made a play, you know, for a vertically integrated operation. And I think what we're seeing, particularly because of the small size of the market, is that where there are players who are able to participate in multiple parts of the value chain, they're able to get greater, you know, share of the pot, if you will. So, you know, I think that that has been, that's a winning strategy for now. As the market gets bigger, there will be an opportunity to for companies to specialize in different parts of the value chain and still be successful, you know, commercially. So I think that we'll see more of that moving into the future. And the other thing is that, you know, differentiation is pretty critical. And at the moment, it's quite difficult to differentiate on these medicines because they are, you know, by and large a commodity. We see some differentiation with, you know, delivery formats and those sorts of things. But I think that in the future, we'll see R&D and IP development start to really set companies apart, and we'll see, you know, kind of value coming from that. I think that in the sort of short to medium term, companies who are looking outside of the sort of product portfolio to innovate and to create new value will be successful, particularly if they can solve some of the pain points that are being felt by patients. Things like we've talked about price already, access, you know, the CAMS 20 survey, I think 25% or 24% of respondents who are using prescription channels still say that it's not easy enough. So there's a lot of work there that needs to be done. So my answer is different depending on what timeline you're looking at.
And yeah, the other thing is, I mean, you've chatted about this. I think I saw you present on this at UIC. You know, there are other factors that are, you know, largely or partly outside of the industry's control. Things like, you know, rec exports to places like Germany, assuming that Germany goes the way we expect it to. And, you know, recreational legalization here, for example. So, you know, are there, you know, what are the big things, what are the big external factors do you think that will ultimately come into play?
Yeah. So I love thinking about this because I think it's a really big, you know, it's fun to think about the challenges for the industry, but it's also fun to kind of hypothesize about the different scenarios that might emerge. If I tackle the export one first, so, you know, what happens internationally with adult use markets has the potential to significantly change the market dynamics in Australia, particularly for companies that are, you know, producing, manufacturing, cultivating, etc. onshore. We're all watching the German market pretty closely to see how that market is going to be regulated and whether other markets that have, you know, adult use on their agenda follow the Canadian model, for example, or whether there's a model that sort of has different requirements around quality and those sorts of things. If the trends follow the Canadian market, then that's where we're potentially in a bit of trouble. And the reason for that is that when the adult use market was legalized in Canada, it was within a couple of years that we saw the medical market completely shrink. I think it was 12% or something like that of the recreational market. And the challenge for that for us is that if the global market follows suit, then we as Australian companies can't export to recreational markets right now. And that effectively means that we're locking ourselves into a sort of what is effectively a shrinking market. And so I think that it's quite important for us as an industry to be talking about how we open up that export pathway. I think that we then it opens up new challenges. We need to address how we're going to compete cost effectively or how we carve out a premium position, maybe as, you know, Australian made brands overseas. But there is a challenge that we'll need to sort of address there. And as you said, you know, this is in lockstep, I believe, with the adult use conversation in Australia, because I can't imagine a situation where we are able to open up an export pathway to recreational markets overseas, but we say to the Australian citizens, sorry, we still don't let you do that in Australia. I think that there'd be a little bit of furor around that. So, yeah, on the adult use, I get asked a lot when I, if I think that the adult use market is going to come to fruition in Australia and when, and it's a very, I do believe it will. The when question is a really tough one to answer, but the reason I believe it will is because I watch a couple of things pretty closely. So I watch what's happening overseas and I watch what's happening at home. Overseas, it's, you know, what's happening from a regulatory perspective. So how are Germany going to regulate? What's going to happen in Switzerland when they finish their trial? You know, what about Mexico and Spain and all of the other countries that are having adult use conversations? And how might that change the expectations of Australians in terms of what they believe is right, you know, for the cannabis market in Australia? At home, what I watch for is sentiment shift. And there was a sentiment shift that came to light fairly recently, which I thought was interesting. It was the 2019 Australian Institute of Health and Welfare. You know, they do the drug household survey every couple of years. And they look at perception of different different drugs, and they looked at perception of cannabis. And 41% of participants said that they support legalization for personal use. Now, what was interesting is that that was a statistically significant increase on the previous survey, which was 2016, and that was 35% of people supporting legalization. Now, the 2022 survey, I think, is in field at the moment, and I'll be fascinated to see whether we see continue to see that jump and whether we actually start to get that sort of groundswell of support.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well,
Sorry, mate, you go.
No, you go, Jonesy. We've got a slight time delay. I should explain to people that I'm actually in the UK at the moment. So hence the fact that Steve and I keep talking over each other. But carry on. You carry on.
No, I was just going to ask Cass. I mean, what is your best guess in terms of when the rec market will materialise in Australia? I know it's a $64,000 question, yeah. But what's your rough estimate?
So, for the last couple of years, I've been saying 5 years, 5 years, 5 years. I'm going to say 5 years, maybe three. I don't think it's something that's going to happen immediately, but I do see the signals for the shift. I think what's important for us as an industry, a medical industry, is that we need to be on the front foot of designing what an adult use market could look like in Australia, so that we've got really clearly defined boundaries between adult use, wellness, and medical. And what we want to avoid is we want to make sure we don't see erosion of the medical market if adult use opens up here. We want to make sure there aren't patients who are self-medicating through retail channels. We want to ensure that the medical industry have the option to, first option to participate in the adult market if they want to, so that all of the knowledge and experience and investment and all of those sorts of things that have gone into this industry since 2016 are still kind of captured and that the companies can create value from that. So, you know, I really hope that as the conversation starts to gain traction, that the voices get louder, that we're at the forefront of that and helping shape it.
I might just chip in on that as well. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Everybody always talks in terms of, and I do too, is 3 to 5 years. And I think that's just because of the election cycle being 3 years. And then you think maybe it'll be a couple of years after an election that something might happen. I mean, the thing that I think we see globally is, you know, I think I've said this before, that I haven't yet seen a politician who's actually in a position of real power burn political capital on this one. It tends to be bottom up rather than top down. So it is, as you say, Cass, when you get those, you know, that sentiment tips, then it tends to be politicians taking an action rather than kind of leading from the front. But we're seeing that. Obviously, the election result was quite significant, and you know, surveys coming out suggesting that there is a groundswell of support now for legalization. The other thing, you know, I've thought about a lot is just the fact that Australia, being a state-based system, feels like it will be easier for a state to make a move, and then that might create some sort of domino effect. You know, a bit like we've seen in the US. So I'm a 3 to 5 year guy as well. The other thing I was just going to bring in here is we did a story last week just about the impact that legalization of both recreational and medicinal markets actually has had on big pharma in the US, both in terms of impact on sales and impact on share price. What do you think Big Pharma's reaction to that is likely to be? I mean, you know, presumably they'll just try and buy a slice of the action, won't they?
Oh, I think so. I think about these guys as sleeping giants, and I thought that research was absolutely fascinating. I mean, this has not been lost on them. I suspect that what's happening is that they're letting the cannabis companies do the hard yards. They're letting the cannabis companies invest in the R&D, take the risks, build the market, and then when they see that there's a commercial opportunity there, they'll come in and acquire. And, you know, it's the Jazz Pharmaceutical GW playbook, and I think that we'll see that play out, you know, over and over into the future, probably over the next 20 years realistically. But yeah, I believe that they will absolutely step into the market when the time feels right.
Okay, look, we're going to have to move on, I think. Fascinating stuff. Now, the other story that caught my eye last week was actually not one in cannabis, but one in MJ Biz Daily, talking about the rivalry between the National Cannabis Industry Association and the recently launched US Cannabis Council. Now, here, of course, we've got three trade associations servicing a far smaller market, the Australian Medicinal Cannabis Association, Medicinal Cannabis Industry Australia, and the recently launched Emerging Therapeutics Association of Australia. I think these bodies all argue that they've got, you know, they perform different roles, there's room for everyone, but there are concerns that, you know, too many voices might hamper kind of lobbying efforts. Cass, I might start with you, because you've obviously, like me and like Steve, actually worked in markets outside of cannabis. What's your kind of experience been with trade bodies in those other industries?
Yeah, so I've worked in lots of industries from a sort of consulting perspective, and you do often see multiple industry bodies, but it tends to be in bigger, more established industries. And you know, as you say, they're bodies or groups who tend to serve different needs of or parts of that industry. And so personally, I don't see the benefit in such a young industry of having three industry bodies. I do see the benefit of diversity of thought and diversity of opinion. I think that is really important. But we are a small industry, and I think that we should be mindful that, you know, we need to continue to make strides quickly. And to do that, we need the time and the attention of government. And with three industry bodies, I think we're at risk of diluting the time and attention, and also diluting some of the key messages that we need to get across. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that you get further faster together. And, you know, what I would like to see is for us to present the industry, you know, present the industry as being strong and aligned. I would like to see a shared industry strategy. So the Pharmacy Guild, for example, have done an excellent job of this. They've worked with the pharmacy industry to develop a vision for 2025 now, as of a couple of years ago, I suppose, that they did the work. But it's a vision that the industry can rally around, that they understand collectively where they're trying to go and the changes that they need, you know, that they're trying to make. It's directing education, it's directing investment, those sorts of things. So I think we'd benefit from that. I think we'd benefit from maybe establishing with a little bit more clarity what the roles are for the different industry groups, and then really, you know, being a little bit more collaborative in our advocacy efforts and aligning collaborating where we've got issues that they're aligning around, collaborating on advocacy so that we're not diluting that time and attention.
Jonesy, I want to bring you in here because you're quite close to this. You've reported on the Alliance meeting recently and other stuff. How do you think this situation will kind of play out?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, this. I mean, certainly AMCAR and MCIA believe there is too much fragmentation. And I think it's pretty clear there is. Yes, all three groups reckon they have different aims and fulfill a different role. And I think it's true to a point. But I'm not so sure politicians regard it and look at it that way. Three knocks on the door from the same industry, it's too much. It's not the way forward for the industry, I don't think. I mean, how will it resolve itself? ETAA, they're not about to pack up. I think that's clear. AMCAR and MCIA, as I said, realise that three voices is too many. I think that they're just too different to come together. You've got AMCAR, which prefers a more robust lobbying style. They want to rattle cages. Nothing wrong with that. MCIA prefer sort of more quiet diplomacy. And I think merging those two approaches is going to be too difficult. I think there'll be issues where the two can come together, where there really are, you know, issues that they both can speak about in harmony, as it were. But I think for the foreseeable future, we're going to be stuck with three. Well, stuck is probably the wrong way of putting it, but we're going to have three industry voices for the foreseeable.
I think you're right, Steve. And I have seen, sorry, Martin, I have seen some collaboration already. So it's not to say that it's not there, which is excellent. I think we just need to build a little, you know, keep building on that and try and find more common areas where we can have one voice with government.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with ETAA as well, because obviously they've kind of their pitch has been, we represent, you know, a broader church than just medicinal cannabis. We're also, you know, looking at psilocybin and vaping and other emerging therapeutics. But in reality, the majority of their members are medicinal cannabis companies, some of whom have a kind of psilocybin sort of interest. So that'll be interesting to see whether that does genuinely become a body that represents a broader church. So yeah, we'll kind of see what happens with that. But I'm sort of with you, Steve. I don't see a coming together, a formal coming together anytime soon, but hopefully there will be more collaboration so that we can kind of lead with, you know, one voice rather than three, which I think just gets difficult from a lobbying point of view. Just another story, Steve, you wrote about this one actually, which was Cannaponics chairman Steve Birkbeck has unveiled plans to build a cannabis retreat in WA where guests will be offered legally prescribed medicinal cannabis. You chatted to Steve Birkbeck last week. What did you make of his plans?
Yeah, fascinating. Obviously, it's the first of its kind in Australia, the first I'm aware of anyway. And his passion for the scheme is very apparent. He truly believes in it, as you'd expect him to. I think it's fair to say it's not a fully formed plan yet in terms of the details of how the prescribing will actually work. My understanding is that guests or visitors will be prescribed on the premises, but whether you can take your existing medication to the retreat, I'm not too sure. So I think there's details to work out. But yeah, I mean, it's a great idea. He's going to target, I think, mainly predominantly patients in WA, but I think he's going to look into the Asian market as well to try and draw some international visitation. And I get the feeling it's going to be similar in style to the Gaia retreat in Queensland, the one obviously that Olivia Newton-John formed. It's going to have that sort of vibe to it, I think, but with that cannabis, medicinal cannabis element. So, yeah, I think if it's successful, you know, you could roll out two or three, and other companies might take an interest and see if that can develop. So yeah, interesting idea.
And Cass, we've seen an explosion of cannabis tourism in Colorado since legalization there, and you know, Amsterdam's kind of been at it for years. But given Australia's kind of heavy regulation, could it become a major tourism hub without that adult use market? Because obviously Steve Birkbeck is trying to operate within the confines of a medicinal market, but without rec, it's never going to be a huge. Cannabis tourism isn't going to be a big thing here, is it?
Look, I don't think so. And, you know, it's interesting to hear, Steve, you talk about the sort of health and wellness aspect, because when I first heard about this and when I first heard about there's a cafe that's opening where, you know, patients can go and consume their medication, smoke their medication together, you do kind of look at it and think, are they just companies that are readying themselves for the rec market? And so I think for any type of meaningful cannabis tourism, there's got to be some kind of meaningful reason for a cannabis patient to be in one of these places or be at one of those retreats. And, you know, I guess that begs the question, what do the peripheral services or support systems look like that make that value proposition make sense in a medical market rather than a recreational market? So I'll be very intrigued to see how it's received, not only by, you know, the general public and the patients, but also the regulator and some of the medical bodies. I love the innovation of it though. So I kind of look at it and I like that they're having a go, and I like that they're thinking about this. And, you know, it's big bucks overseas, cannabis tourism. I think it's $17 billion in the US. I'd like to see them think about a therapeutic benefit beyond just going to a beautiful sort of health and wellness facility, which there are lots of them around. I think that's where it starts to make sense to me. I was looking at some of the cannabis tourism stuff in the US actually, and there's one that really tickled me. I don't know if you've seen it. It's called Bud and Breakfast.
Very good. Very good. I like it already.
I love it. It looks like it's it kind of looks like an Airbnb where the accommodation that's there on offer is either tolerant of, you know, consuming cannabis recreationally, or they kind of go the next step and they offer cannabis tours, cannabis like CBD massages. So that's something that perhaps you could put into a health and wellness setting where it has some kind of therapeutic, it makes sense therapeutically as well as being part of that kind of beautiful health and wellness experience. They've got cannabis yoga. I don't really know what that means or but what you do. And then food, cannabis food. So, you know, again, I don't, yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how that all comes together.
Finally, last but not least, evidence has emerged debunking the myth of the lazy stoner after Cambridge University researchers found regular users appeared no more likely to lack motivation than non-users. So, Jonesy, can you be bothered to comment on this one?
I thought we'd finished. This obviously dates back to the Stoner Sloth campaign. I'm not sure if you mentioned that, Martin, but this is a campaign. Yeah, I think it's in 2015 it started in Australia, where they had a sloth was sort of a stoner who was sort of moping around the place and couldn't form a sentence and couldn't tell the difference between some salt and a salad. You need to watch the videos to really find out what that's about. So I think so. That was hard on sloths, to be honest. Slow of movement doesn't mean dim-witted.
That's
in my
a very case, interesting but... angle to take to defend the sloth. I didn't imagine that was the angle that you would come from, but you know, interesting thoughts.
The problem with that campaign is that the government were just reinforcing a myth by sort of by depicting every stoner to be
I don't remember it
out of their skulls. It was factually inaccurate apart from anything else, and the target market just thought it was laughable. It got derided overseas as well. It was absolute nonsense.
I will do it right after this.
It was a very big campaign in it was Australia, wasn't it? It was an Australian-based campaign. So they'd have this sort of, you know, sloth in school, kind of slumped over the desk, you know, etc. And it reminded me, you know, a little bit of, you know, we've seen like that, you know, that Just Say No campaign in the UK years and years ago. They're just real blunt instruments, aren't they? That have absolutely no resonance, with the target audience, because the target audience go, well, that's just rubbish. I'm not like that. What are you talking about?
Swearing at international tourists. Where the bloody hell are you?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I just find it quite interesting.
Has now been proven.
Yeah, I find it quite interesting that people actually are doing research into trying to prove, you know, disprove a negative in that way. And I can understand why, because there's the, you know, because the perception is that's what, you know, stoners are like, sort of thing.
It is incredible.
Yeah, it struck me as one of those.
I was just going to say, it is very helpful.
Yes, it is very helpful. Yeah, I mean, it's still one of those things that always strikes me as it's not probably going to change people's minds, because people sort of either think one thing or the other. I'm not sure that it makes any difference. But as you say, it helps. If it helps to reduce the stigma around cannabis, then it's got to be a positive. All right, I think we're going to leave it there. Thanks, Cass, for joining us. Good to chat.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Jonesy. Good to see you. Jonesy, I should explain actually that Jonesy's actually in my house recording this podcast at the moment, because I'm in the UK and Jonesy's in my house, which is really quite weird. I hope you've left. I hope you've left it in a good state.
Well, I was actually at your house last week and it was fine, but your kids had a party at the weekend.
I was going to say, did Martin leave it in a good state?
Oh dear. On that note, I think we'll end this podcast and I'll go and ring my children and see what's happened to my house.
And phone a cleaning company while you're at it.
All right, cheers.
To hear more, subscribe to the podcast. To see more, catabiz.com.au.